Side 11. The City and the Stars and the Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. Continuing with The Sands of Mars on page 433. The aircraft leveled out on an easterly course and the great island of Aurorae Cygnus sank over the edge of the planet. Apart from a few oases, the open desert now lay ahead for thousands of kilometers. The pilot switched his controls to automatic and came amidships to talk to his passengers.
"We'll be at Charontis in about 4 hours," he said. "I'm afraid there isn't much to look at on the way, though you'll see some fine colour effects when we go over Euphrates. After that, it's more or less uniform desert until we hit the Syrtis Major."
Gibson did some rapid mental arithmetic.
"Let's see. We're flying east and we started rather late. It'll be dark when we get there."
"Don't worry about that. We'll pick up the Charontis beacon when we're a couple of hundred kilometers away. Mars is so small that you don't often do a long-distance trip in daylight all the way."
"How long have you been on Mars?"
asked Gibson, who had now ceased taking photos through the observation ports.
"Oh, 5 years."
"Flying all the time?"
"Most of it."
"Wouldn't you prefer being in spaceships?"
"Not likely. No excitement in it. Just floating around in nothing for months."
He grinned at Hilton, who smiled amiably but showed no inclination to argue.
"Just what do you mean by excitement?" said Gibson anxiously.
"Well, you've got some scenery to look at. You're not away from home for very long, and there's always the chance you may find something new. I've done half a dozen trips over the poles, you know, most of them in summer, but I went across the Mare Boreum last winter. 150 degrees below outside. That's the record so far for Mars."
"I can beat that pretty easily," said Hilton.
"At night, it reaches 200 below on Titan."
It was the first time Gibson had ever heard him refer to the Saturnia expedition.
"By the way, Fred," he asked, "is this rumor true?"
"What rumor?"
"You know, that you're going to have another shot at Saturn."
Hilton shrugged his shoulders.
"It isn't decided. There are a lot of difficulties. But I think it will come off. It would be a pity to miss the chance.
You see, if we can leave next year, we can go past Jupiter on the way and have our first really good look at him. Max worked out a very interesting orbit for us. We go rather close to Jupiter, right inside all the satellites, and let his gravitational field swing us round so that we head out in the right direction for Saturn. It'll need rather accurate navigation to give us just the orbit we want, but it can be done."
"Then what's holding it up?"
"Money, as usual. The trip will last 2.5 years, and will cost about $50 million. Mars can't afford it. It would mean doubling the usual deficit. At the moment, we're trying to get Earth to foot the bill."
"It would come to that anyway in the long run," said Gibson.
"But give me all the facts when we get home, and I'll write a blistering exposé about cheese-pairing terrestrial politicians. You mustn't underestimate the power of the press."
The talk then drifted from planet to planet, until Gibson suddenly remembered that he was wasting a magnificent chance of seeing Mars at first hand. Obtaining permission to occupy the pilot's seat, after promising not to touch anything, he went forward and settled himself comfortably behind the controls. 5 kilometers below, the colored desert was streaking past him to the west. They were flying at what on Earth would have been a very low altitude, for the thinness of the Martian air made it essential to keep as near the surface as safety allowed. Gibson had never before received such an impression of sheer speed, for though he had flown in much faster machines on Earth, that had always been at heights where the ground was invisible. The nearness of the horizon added to the effect, for an object which appeared over the edge of the planet would be passing beneath a few minutes later. From time to time the pilot came forward to check the course, though it was a pure formality, as there was nothing he need do until the voyage was nearly over. At midpoint, some coffee and light refreshments were produced, and Gibson rejoined his companions in the cabin. Hilton and the pilot were now arguing briskly about Venus, quite a sore point with the Martian colonists who regarded that peculiar planet as a complete waste of time.
The sun was now very low in the west, and even the stunted Martian hills threw long shadows across the desert. Down there, the temperature was already below freezing point, and falling fast. The few hardy plants that had survived in this almost barren waste would have folded their leaves tightly together, conserving warmth and energy against the rigors of the night. Gibson yawned and stretched himself. The swiftly unfolding landscape had an almost hypnotic effect, and it was difficult to keep awake. He decided to catch some sleep in the 90 or so minutes that were left of the voyage. Some change in the failing light must have woken him. For a moment, it was impossible to believe that he was not still dreaming. He could only sit and stare, paralyzed with sheer astonishment. No longer was he looking out across a flat, almost featureless landscape, meeting the deep blue of the sky at the far horizon. Desert and horizon had both vanished. In their place, towered a range of crimson mountains, reaching north and south as far as the eye could follow. The last rays of the setting sun caught their peaks and bequeathed to them its dying glory. Already the foothills were lost in the night that was sweeping onwards to the west. For long seconds, the splendor of the scene robbed it of all reality and hence all menace. Then Gibson awoke from his trance, realizing in one dreadful instant that they were flying far too low to clear those Himalayan peaks. The sense of utter panic lasted only a moment, to be followed at once by a far deeper terror. Gibson had remembered now what the first shock had banished from his mind, the simple fact he should have thought of from the beginning. There were no mountains on Mars. Hadfield was dictating an urgent memorandum to the Interplanetary Development Board when the news came through. Port Schiaparelli had waited the regulation 15 minutes after the aircraft's expected time of arrival, and Port Lowell Control had stood by for another 10 before sending out the overdue signal. One precious aircraft from the tiny Martian fleet was already standing by to search the line of flight as soon as dawn came. The high speed and low altitude essential for flight would make such a search very difficult, but when Phobos rose, the telescopes up there could join in with far greater prospects of success. The news reached Earth an hour later, at a time when there was nothing much else to occupy press or radio. Gibson would have been well satisfied by the resultant publicity. Everywhere people began reading his last articles with a morbid interest. Ruth Goldstein knew nothing about it until an editor she was dealing with arrived waving the evening paper. She immediately sold the second reprint rights of Gibson's latest series for half as much again as her victim had intended to pay, then retired to her private room and wept copiously for a full minute. Both these events would have pleased Gibson enormously. In a score of newspaper offices, the copy culled from the morgue began to be set up in type so that no time would be wasted. And in London, a publisher who had paid Gibson a rather large advance began to feel very unhappy indeed. Gibson's shout was still echoing through the cabin when the pilot reached the controls. Then he was flung to the floor as the machine turned over in an almost vertical bank in a desperate attempt to swing round to the north. When Gibson could climb to his feet again, he caught a glimpse of a strangely blurred orange cliff sweeping down upon them from only kilometers away. Even in that moment of panic, he could see that there was something very curious about that swiftly approaching barrier. And suddenly the truth dawned upon him at last. This was no mountain range, but something that might be no less deadly. They were running into a windborne wall of sand, reaching from the desert almost to the edge of the stratosphere. The hurricane hit them a second later. Something slapped the machine violently from side to side, and through the insulation of the hull came an angry whistling roar that was the most terrifying sound Gibson had ever heard in his life. Night had come instantly upon them, and they were flying helplessly through a howling darkness. It was all over in 5 minutes, but it seemed a lifetime. Their sheer speed had saved them, for the ship had cut through the heart of the hurricane like a projectile. There was a sudden burst of deep ruby twilight. The ship ceased to be pounded by a million sledgehammers, and a ringing silence seemed to fill the little cabin. through the rear observation port. Gibson caught a last glimpse of the storm as it moved westwards, tearing up the desert in its wake. His legs feeling like jellies, Gibson tottered thankfully into his seat and breathed an enormous sigh of relief. For a moment, he wondered if they had been thrown badly off course, then realized that this scarcely mattered considering the navigational aids they carried. It was only then, when his ears had ceased to be deafened by the storm, that Gibson had his second shock. The motors had stopped. The little cabin was very tense and still. Then the pilot called out over his shoulder, "Get your masks on. The hull may crack when we come down." His fingers feeling very clumsy, Gibson dragged his breathing equipment from under the seat and adjusted it over his head. When he had finished, the ground already seemed very close, though it was hard to judge distances in the failing twilight. A low hill swept by and was gone into the darkness. The ship banked violently to avoid another, then gave a sudden spasmodic jerk as it touched ground and bounced. A moment later it made contact again, and Gibson tensed himself for the inevitable crash. It was an age before he dared relax, still unable to believe that they were safely down. Then Hilton stretched himself in his seat, removed his mask, and called out to the pilot, "That was a very nice landing, Skipper. Now how far have we got to walk?" For a moment there was no reply. Then the pilot called, in a rather strained voice, "Can anyone light me a cigarette? I've got the twitch." "Here you are," said Hilton, going forward. "Let's have the cabin lights on now, shall we?" The warm, comfortable glow did much to raise their spirits by banishing the Martian night, which now lay all around. Everyone began to feel ridiculously cheerful, and there was much laughing at quite feeble jokes. The reaction had set in. They were so delighted at still being alive that the 1,000 kilometers separating them from the nearest base scarcely seemed to matter.
"That was quite a storm," said Gibson.
"Does this sort of thing happen very often on Mars? And why didn't we get any warnings?" The pilot, now that he had got over his initial shock, was doing some quick thinking, the inevitable court of inquiry obviously looming large in his mind. Even on autopilot, he should have gone forward more often.
"I've never seen one like it before," he said, "though I've done at least 50 trips between Lowell and Skye. The trouble is that we don't know anything about Martian meteorology, even now, and there are only half a dozen met stations on the planet, not enough to give us an accurate picture. What about Phobos? Couldn't they have seen what was happening and warned us?"
The pilot grabbed his almanac and ruffled rapidly through the pages.
"Phobos hasn't risen yet," he said after a brief calculation. "I guess the storm blew up suddenly out of Hades. Appropriate name, isn't it? And has probably collapsed again now. I don't suppose it went anywhere near Charontis, so they couldn't have warned us either. It was just one of those accidents that's nobody's fault."
This thought seemed to cheer him considerably, but Gibson found it hard to be so philosophical.
"Meanwhile," he retorted, "we're stuck in the middle of nowhere. How long will it take them to find us? Or is there any chance of repairing the ship?"
"Not a hope of that. The jets are ruined. They were made to work on air, not sand, you know."
"Well, can we radio Skye?"
"Not now we're on the ground. But when Phobos rises in, let's see, an hour's time, we'll be able to call the observatory and they can relay us on. That's the way we've got to do all our long-distance stuff here, you know. The ionosphere's too feeble to bounce signals round the way you do on Earth. Anyway, I'll go and check that the radio is okay."
He went forward and started tinkering with the ship's transmitter, while Hilton busied himself checking the heaters and cabin air pressure, leaving the two remaining passengers looking at each other a little thoughtfully.
"This is a fine kettle of fish," exploded Gibson, half in anger and half in amusement. "I've come safely from Earth to Mars, more than 50 million kilometers, and as soon as I set foot inside a miserable aeroplane, this is what happens. I'll stick to spaceships in future."
Jimmy grinned. It'll give us something to tell the others when we get back, won't it? Maybe we'll be able to do some real exploring at last.
He peered through the windows, cupping his hands over his eyes to keep out the cabin light. The surrounding landscape was now in complete darkness, apart from the illumination from the ship.
There seemed to be hills all round us. We were lucky to get down in one piece. Good Lord, there's a cliff here on this side. Another few metres and we'd have gone smack into it.
Any idea where we are? Gibson called to the pilot. This tactless remark earned him a very stony stare.
About 120 east, 20 north. The storm can't have thrown us very far off course.
Then we're somewhere in the Etheria, said Gibson, bending over the maps.
Yes, there's a hilly region marked here. Not much information about it.
It's the first time anyone's ever landed here, that's why. This part of Mars is almost unexplored. It's been thoroughly mapped from the air, but that's all.
Gibson was amused to see how Jimmy brightened at this news. There was certainly something exciting about being in a region where no human foot had ever trodden before.
I hate to cast a gloom over the proceedings, remarked Hilton in a tone of voice hinting that this was exactly what he was going to do. But I'm not at all sure you'll be able to radio Phobos, even when it does rise.
What? Yelped the pilot.
The set's okay. I've just tested it.
Yes, but have you noticed where we are? We can't even see Phobos. That cliff's due south of us and blocks the view completely.
That means that they won't be able to pick up our microwave signals.
What's even worse, they won't be able to locate us in their telescopes.
There was a shocked silence.
Now what do we do? Asked Gibson.
He had a horrible vision of a 1,000-kilometer trek across the desert to Charontis, but dismissed it from his mind at once. They couldn't possibly carry the oxygen for the trip, still less the food and equipment necessary. And no one could spend the night unprotected on the surface of Mars, even here near the equator.
We'll just have to signal in some other way, said Hilton calmly. In the morning, we'll climb those hills and have a look round. Meanwhile, I suggest we take it easy.
He yawned and stretched himself, filling the cabin from ceiling to floor.
We've got no immediate worries. There's air for several days and power in the batteries to keep us warm almost indefinitely. We may get a bit hungry if we're here more than a week, but I don't think that's at all likely to happen.
By kind of unspoken mutual consent, Hilton had taken control. Perhaps he was not even consciously aware of the fact that he was now the leader of the little party. The pilot had delegated his own authority without a second thought.
Phobos rises in an hour, you said? Asked Hilton.
Yes. When does it transit? I can never remember what this crazy little moon of yours gets up to.
Well, it rises in the west and sets in the east about 4 hours later.
So it'll be due south around midnight?
That's right.
Oh, Lord, that means we won't be able to see it anyway. It'll be eclipsed for at least an hour.
What a moon, snorted Gibson. When you want it most badly, you can't even see the blasted thing.
That doesn't matter, said Hilton calmly.
We'll know just where it is, and it won't do any harm to try the radio then. That's all we can do tonight.
Has anyone got a pack of cards?
No?
Then what about entertaining us, Martin, with some of your stories?
It was a rash remark, and Gibson seized his chance immediately.
I wouldn't dream of doing that, he said. You're the one who has the stories to tell.
Hilton stiffened, and for a moment Gibson wondered if he had offended him. He knew that Hilton seldom talked about the Saturnian expedition, but this was too good an opportunity to miss. The chance would never come again, and, as is true of all great adventures, its telling would do their morale good. Perhaps Hilton realized this too, for presently he relaxed and smiled.
You've got me nicely cornered, haven't you, Martin? Well, I'll talk, but on one condition.
What's that?
No direct quotes, please.
As if I would.
And when you do write it up, Let me see the manuscript first.
Of course. This was better than Gibson had dared to hope. He had no immediate intention of writing about Hilton's adventures, but it was nice to know that he could do so if he wished. The possibility that he might never have the chance simply did not cross his mind. Outside the walls of the ship, the fierce Martian night reigned supreme. A night studded with needle-sharp, unwinking stars. The pale light of Deimos made the surrounding landscape dimly visible, as if lit with a cold phosphorescence. Out of the east, Jupiter, the brightest object in the sky, was rising in his glory. But the thoughts of the four men in the crashed aircraft were 600 million kilometers still farther from the sun. It still puzzled many people, the curious fact that man had visited Saturn but not Jupiter, so much closer at hand. But in space travel, sheer distance is of no importance, and Saturn had been reached because of a single astonishing stroke of luck that still seemed too good to be true. Orbiting Saturn was Titan, the largest satellite in the solar system, about twice the size of Earth's moon. As far back as 1944, it had been discovered that Titan possessed an atmosphere. It was not an atmosphere one could breathe. It was immensely more valuable than that. For it was an atmosphere of methane, one of the ideal propellants for atomic rockets. This had given rise to a situation unique in the history of spaceflight. For the first time, an expedition could be sent to a strange world with the virtual certainty that refueling would be possible on arrival. The Arcturus and her crew of six had been launched in space from the orbit of Mars. She had reached the Saturnian systems only 9 months later, with just enough fuel to land safely on Titan. Then the pumps had been started and the great tanks replenished from the countless trillions of tons of methane that were there for the taking. Refueling on Titan whenever necessary, the Arcturus had visited every one of Saturn's 15 known moons, and had even skirted the Great Ring system itself. In a few months, more was learned about Saturn than in all the previous centuries of telescopic examination. There had been a price to pay. Two of the crew had died of radiation sickness after emergency repairs to one of the atomic motors. They had been buried on Dione, the fourth moon, and the leader of the expedition, Captain Envers, had been killed by an avalanche of frozen air on Titan. His body had never been found. Hilton had assumed command and had brought the Arcturus safely back to Mars a year later, with only two men to help him. All these bare facts Gibson knew well enough. He could still remember listening to those radio messages that had come trickling back through space, relayed from world to world. But it was a different thing altogether to hear Hilton telling the story in his quiet, curiously impersonal manner, as if he had been a spectator rather than a participant. He spoke of Titan and its smaller brethren, the little moons which, circling Saturn, made the planet almost a scale model of the solar system. He described how at last they had landed on the innermost moon of all, Mimas, only half as far from Saturn as the moon is from the Earth.
"We came down in a wide valley between a couple of mountains, where we would be sure the ground would be pretty solid. We weren't going to make the mistake we did on Rhea. It was a good landing, and we climbed into our suits to go outside. It's funny how impatient you always are to do that, no matter how many times you've set down on a new world. Of course, my mass hasn't much gravity, only a hundredth of Earth's. That was enough to keep us from jumping off into space. I liked it that way. You knew you'd always come down safely again if you waited long enough. It was early in the morning when we landed. My mass has a day a bit shorter than Earth's. It goes round Saturn in 22 hours, and as it keeps the same face towards the planet, its day and month are the same length, just as they are on the moon. We'd come down in the northern hemisphere, not far from the equator, and most of Saturn was above the horizon. It looked quite weird, a huge crescent horn sticking up into the sky, like some impossibly bent mountain thousands of miles high. Of course, you've all seen the films we made, especially the speeded-up color one showing a complete cycle of Saturn's phases.
but I don't think they can give you much idea of what it was like to live with that enormous thing always there in the sky. It was so big, you see, that one couldn't take it in a single view. If you stood facing it and held your arms wide open, you could just imagine your fingertips touching the opposite ends of the rings. We couldn't see the rings themselves very well, because they were almost edge-on. But you could always tell they were there by the wide, dusky band of shadow they cast on the planet. None of us ever got tired of watching it. It's spinning so fast, you know. The pattern was always changing. The cloud formations, if that's what they were, used to whip round from one side of the disk to the other in a few hours, changing continually as they moved. And there were the most wonderful colors, greens and browns and yellows chiefly. Now and then there'd be great slow eruptions, and something as big as Earth would rise up out of the depths and spread itself sluggishly in a huge stain halfway round the planet. You could never take your eyes off it for long. Even when it was new and so completely invisible, you could still tell it was there because of the great hole in the stars. And here's a funny thing which I haven't reported because I was never quite sure of it. Once or twice, when we were in the planet's shadow and its disk should have been completely dark, I thought I saw a faint fluorescent glow coming from the night side. It didn't last long, if it really happened at all. Perhaps it was some kind of chemical reaction going on down there in that spinning cauldron. Are you surprised that I want to go to Saturn again? What I'd like to do is to get really close this time. And by that I mean within 1,000 kilometers. It should be quite safe and wouldn't take much power. All you need do is to go into a parabolic orbit and let yourself fall in like a comet going round the sun. Of course, you'd only spend a few minutes actually close to Saturn, but you could get a lot of records in that time. And I want to land on my mass again and see that great shining crescent reaching halfway up the sky. It'll be worth the journey, just to watch Saturn waxing and waning, and to see the storms chasing themselves round his equator. Yes, it would be worth it. Even if I didn't get back this time. There were no mock heroics in this closing remark. It was merely a simple statement of fact, and Hilton's listeners believed him completely. While the spell lasted, every one of them would be willing to strike the same bargain. Gibson ended the long silence by going to the cabin window and peering out into the night. "Can we have the lights off?" he called. Complete darkness fell as the pilot obeyed his request. The others joined him at the window. "Look," said Gibson. "Up there. You can just see it if you crane your neck." The cliff against which they were lying was no longer a wall of absolute and unrelieved darkness. On its very topmost peaks, a new light was playing, spilling over the broken crags and filtering down into the valley. Phobos had leapt out of the west and was climbing on its meteoric rise towards the south, racing backwards across the sky. Minute by minute, the light grew stronger, and presently the pilot began to send out his signals. He had barely begun when the pale moonlight was snuffed out so suddenly that Gibson gave a cry of astonishment. Phobos had gone hurtling into the shadow of Mars, and though it was still rising, it would cease to shine for almost an hour. There was no way of telling whether or not it would peep over the edge of the great cliff and so be in the right position to receive their signals. They did not give up hope for almost 2 hours. Suddenly the light reappeared on the peaks, but shining now from the east. Phobos had emerged from its eclipse and was now dropping down towards the horizon, which it would reach in little more than an hour. The pilot switched off his transmitter in disgust. "It's no good," he said. "We'll have to try something else." "I know," Gibson exclaimed excitedly. "Can't we carry the transmitter up the top of the hill?" "I'd thought of that, but it would be the devil's own job to get it out without proper tools. The whole thing, aerials and all, is built into the hull." "There's nothing more we can do tonight anyway," said Hilton. "I suggest we all get some sleep before dawn. Good night, everybody." It was excellent advice, but not easy to follow. Gibson's mind was still racing ahead, making plans for the morrow. Not until Phobos had at last plunged down into the east, and its light had ceased to play mockingly on the cliff above them, did he finally pass into a fitful slumber. Even then he dreamed that he was trying to fix a belt drive from the motors to the tractor undercarriage so that they could taxi the last 1,000 kilometers to Port Schiaparelli. Chapter 12. When Gibson woke, it was long after dawn. The sun was invisible behind the cliffs, but its rays reflected from the scarlet crags above them flooded the cabin with an unearthly, even a sinister light. He stretched himself stiffly. These seats had not been designed to sleep in, and he had spent an uncomfortable night. He looked round for his companions, and realized that Hilton and the pilot had gone. Jimmy was still fast asleep. The others must have awakened first and gone out to explore. Gibson felt a vague annoyance at being left behind, but knew that he would have been still more annoyed if they had interrupted his slumbers. There was a short message from Hilton, pinned prominently on the wall. It said simply, "Went outside at 6:30. We'll be gone about an hour. We'll be hungry when we get back. Fred." The hint could hardly be ignored. Besides, Gibson felt hungry himself. He rummaged through the emergency food pack which the aircraft carried for such accidents, wondering as he did so just how long it would have to last them. His attempts to brew a hot drink in the tiny pressure boiler aroused Jimmy, who looked somewhat sheepish when he realized he was the last to wake. "Had a good sleep?" asked Gibson as he searched round for the cups.
"Awful," said Jimmy, running his hands through his hair. "I feel I haven't slept for a week. Where are the others?"
His question was promptly answered by the sounds of someone entering the airlock. A moment later, Hilton appeared, followed by the pilot. They divested themselves of masks and heating equipment. It was still around freezing point outside, and advanced eagerly on the pieces of chocolate and compressed meat, which Gibson had portioned out with impeccable fairness.
"Well," said Gibson anxiously, "what's the verdict?" "I can tell you one thing right away," said Hilton between mouthfuls. "We're damn lucky to be alive."
"I know that."
"You don't know the half of it. You haven't seen just where we landed. We came down parallel to this cliff for almost 1 kilometer before we stopped. If we'd swerved a couple of degrees to starboard, bang! When we touched down, we did swing inwards a bit, but not enough to do any damage. We're in a long valley running east and west. It looks like a geological fault, rather than an old riverbed, though that was my first guess. The cliff opposite us is a good 100 meters high, and practically vertical. In fact, it's got a bit of overhang near the top. Maybe it can be climbed farther along, but we didn't try. There's no need to. Anyway, if we want Phobos to see us, we've only got to walk a little way to the north, until the cliff doesn't block the view. In fact, I think that may be the answer. If we can push this ship out into the open, it'll mean we can use the radio, and we'll give the telescopes and air search a better chance of spotting us."
"How much does this thing weigh?" said Gibson doubtfully.
"About 30 tons with full load. There's a lot of stuff we can take out, of course."
"No, there isn't," said the pilot. "That would mean letting down our pressure, and we can't afford to waste air."
"Oh, Lord, I'd forgotten that. Still, the ground's fairly smooth, and the undercart's perfectly okay."
Gibson made noises indicating extreme doubt. Even under 1/3 of Earth's gravity, moving the aircraft was not going to be an easy proposition. For the next few minutes, his attention was diverted to the coffee, which he had tried to pour out before it had cooled sufficiently. Releasing the pressure on the boiler immediately filled the room with steam, so that for a moment it looked as if everyone was going to inhale their liquid refreshment. Making hot drinks on Mars was always a nuisance, since water, under normal pressure, boiled at around 60 degrees centigrade, and cooks who forgot this elementary fact usually met with disaster. The dull but nourishing meal
was finished in silence as the castaways pondered their pet plans for rescue. They were not really worried. They knew that an intensive search would now be in progress, and it could only be a matter of time before they were located. But that time could be reduced to a few hours if they could get some kind of signal to Phobos. After breakfast, they tried to move the ship. By dint of much pushing and pulling, they managed to shift it a good 5 meters. Then the caterpillar tracks sank into soft ground, and as far as their combined efforts were concerned, the machine might have been completely bogged. They retired, panting, into the cabin to discuss the next move. "Have we anything white which we could spread out over a large area?" asked Gibson. This excellent idea came to nothing when an intensive search of the cabin revealed 6 handkerchiefs and a few pieces of grimy rag. It was agreed that, even under the most favorable conditions, these would not be visible from Phobos. "There's only one thing for it," said Hilton. "We'll have to rip out the landing lights, run them out on a cable until they're clear of the cliff, and aim them at Phobos. I didn't want to do this if it could be avoided. It might make a mess of the wing, and it's a pity to break up a good aeroplane." By his glum expression, it was obvious that the pilot agreed with these sentiments. Jimmy was suddenly struck with an idea. "Why not fix up a heliograph?" he asked. "If we flashed a mirror on Phobos, they ought to be able to see that."
"Across 6,000 kilometers? Said Gibson doubtfully.
"Why not? They've got telescopes that magnify more than 1,000 up there. Couldn't you see a mirror flashing in the sun if it was only 6 kilometers away?"
"I'm sure there's something wrong with that calculation, though I don't know what," said Gibson. "Things never work out as simply as that. But I agree with the general idea. Now who's got a mirror?"
After a quarter hour's search, Jimmy's scheme had to be abandoned. There simply was no such thing as a mirror on the ship.
"We could cut out a piece of the wing and polish that up," said Hilton thoughtfully. "That would be almost as good."
"This magnesium alloy won't take much of a polish," said the pilot, still determined to defend his machine to the last. Gibson suddenly shot to his feet.
"Will someone kick me 3 times round the cabin?"
he announced to the assembly.
"With pleasure," grinned Hilton. "But tell us why."
Without answering, Gibson went to the rear of the ship and began rummaging among his luggage, keeping his back to the interested spectators. It took him only a moment to find what he wanted. Then he swung quickly round.
"Here's the answer," he said triumphantly.
A flash of intolerable light suddenly filled the cabin, flooding every corner with a harsh brilliance and throwing distorted shadows on the wall. It was as if lightning had struck the ship, and for several minutes everyone was half-blinded, still carrying on their retinas a frozen picture of the cabin as seen in that moment of searing incandescence.
"I'm sorry," said Gibson contritely. "I've never used it at full power indoors before. That was intended for night work in the open."
"Phew," said Hilton, rubbing his eyes.
"I thought you'd let off an atomic bomb. Must you scare everyone to death when you photograph them?"
"It's only like this for normal indoor use," said Gibson, demonstrating.
Everyone flinched again, but this time the flash seemed scarcely noticeable.
"It's a special job I had made for me before I left Earth. I wanted to be quite sure I could do color photography at night if I wanted to. So far, I haven't had a real chance of using it."
"Let's have a look at the thing," said Hilton. Gibson handed over the flash gun and explained its operation.
"It's built round a supercapacity condenser. There's enough for about 100 flashes on one charge, and it's practically full."
100 of the high-powered flashes?"
"Yes, it'll do 2,000 of the normal ones."
"Then there's enough electrical energy to make a good bomb in that condenser. I hope it doesn't spring a leak."
Hilton was examining the little gas discharge tube, only the size of a marble, at the center of the small reflector.
"Can we focus this thing to get a good beam?" he asked.
"There's a catch behind the reflector. That's the idea. It's rather a broad beam, but it'll help."
Hilton looked very pleased.
They ought to see this thing on Phobos, even in broad daylight, if they're watching this part with a good telescope. We mustn't waste flashes, though.
Phobos is well up now, isn't it? Asked Gibson. I'm going out to have a shot right away.
He got to his feet and began to adjust his breathing equipment.
Don't use more than 10 flashes, warned Hilton. We want to save them for night.
And stand in any shadow you can find.
Can I go out too? Asked Jimmy.
All right, said Hilton. But keep together and don't go wandering off to explore. I'm going to stay here and see if there's anything we can do with the landing lights.
The fact that they now had a definite plan of action had raised their spirits considerably. Clutching his camera and the precious flash gun close to his chest, Gibson bounded across the valley like a young gazelle. It was a curious fact that on Mars one quickly adjusted one's muscular efforts to the lower gravity, and so normally used strides no greater than on Earth. But the reserve of power was available when necessity or high spirits demanded it. They soon left the shadow of the cliff and had a clear view of the open sky. Phobos was already high in the west, a little half-moon which would rapidly narrow to a thin crescent as it raced towards the south. Gibson regarded it thoughtfully, wondering if at this very moment someone might be watching this part of Mars. It seemed highly probable, for the approximate position of their crash would be known. He felt an irrational impulse to dance around and wave his arms, even to shout, "Here we are, can't you see us?" What would this region look like in the telescopes which were, he hoped, now sweeping Etheria? They would show the mottled green of the vegetation through which he was trudging, and the great cliff would be clearly visible as a red band, casting a broad shadow over the valley when the sun was low. There would be scarcely any shadow now, for it was only a few hours from noon. The best thing to do, Gibson decided, was to get in the middle of the darkest area of vegetation he could find. About a kilometer from the crashed ship, the ground sloped down slightly, and here, in the lowest part of the valley, was a wide brownish belt, which seemed to be covered with tall weeds. Gibson headed for this, Jimmy following close behind. They found themselves among slender, leathery plants of a type they had never seen before. The leaves rose vertically out of the ground in long, thin streamers, and were covered with numberless pods, which looked as if they might contain seeds. The flat sides were all turned towards the sun, and Gibson was interested to note that while the sunlit sides of the leaves were black, the shadowed parts were a greyish-white. It was a simple but effective trick to reduce loss of heat. Without wasting time to botanize, Gibson pushed his way into the center of the little forest. The plants were not crowded too closely together, and it was fairly easy to force a passage through them. When he had gone far enough, he raised his flash gun and squinted along it at Phobos. The satellite was now a thin crescent not far from the sun, and Gibson felt extremely foolish aiming his flash into the full glare of the summer sky. But the time was really well chosen, for it would be dark on the side of Phobos towards them, and the telescopes there would be observing under favorable conditions. He let off his 10 shots in 5 pairs spaced well apart. This seemed the most economical way of doing it, while still making sure that the signals would look obviously artificial.
"That'll do for today," said Gibson. "We'll save the rest of our ammunition until after dark.
Now let's have a look at these plants. Do you know what they remind me of?"
"Overgrown seaweed," replied Jimmy promptly.
"Right first time.
I wonder what's in those pots.
Have you got a knife on you?"
"Thanks." Gibson began carving at the nearest frond until he had punctured one of the little black balloons. It apparently held gas, and under considerable pressure, for a faint hiss could be heard as the knife penetrated.
"What queer stuff," said Gibson.
"Let's take some back with us." Not without difficulty, he hacked off one of the long black fronds near the roots. A dark brown fluid began to ooze out of the severed end, releasing tiny bubbles of gas as it did so. With this souvenir hanging over his shoulder, Gibson began to make his way back to the ship. He did not know that he was carrying with him the future of a world. They had gone only a few paces when they encountered a denser patch and had to make a detour. With the sun as a guide, there was no danger of becoming lost, especially in such a small region, and they had made no attempt to retrace their footsteps exactly. Gibson was leading the way and finding it somewhat heavy going. He was just wondering whether to swallow his pride and change places with Jimmy when he was relieved to come across a narrow winding track leading more or less in the right direction. To any observer, it would have been an interesting demonstration of the slowness of some mental processes. For both Gibson and Jimmy had walked a good 6 paces before they remembered the simple but shattering truth that footpaths do not, usually, make themselves.
"It's about time outer explorers came back, isn't it?" said the pilot as he helped Hilton detach the floodlights from the underside of the aircraft's wing. This had proved, after all, to be a fairly straightforward job, and Hilton hoped to find enough wiring inside the machine to run the lights far enough away from the cliff to be visible from Phobos when it rose again. They would not have the brilliance of Gibson's flash, but their steady beams would give them a better chance of being detected.
"How long have they been gone now?" said Hilton.
"About 40 minutes. I hope they've had the sense not to get lost."
"Gibson's too careful to go wandering off. I wouldn't trust young Jimmy by himself, though. He'd want to start looking for Martians."
"Oh, here they are. They seem to be in a bit of a hurry."
2 tiny figures had emerged from the middle distance and were bounding across the valley. Their haste was so obvious that the watchers downed tools and observed their approach with rising curiosity. The fact that Gibson and Jimmy had returned so promptly represented a triumph of caution and self-control. For a long moment of incredulous astonishment, they had stood staring at that pathway through the thin brown plants. On Earth, nothing could have been more commonplace. It was just the sort of track that cattle make across a hill, or wild animals through a forest. Its very familiarity had at first prevented them from noticing it, and even when they had forced their minds to accept its presence, they still kept trying to explain it away. Gibson had spoken first, in a very subdued voice, almost as if he was afraid of being overheard.
"It's a path, all right, Jimmy. But what could have made it, for heaven's sake? No one's ever been here before."
"It must have been some kind of animal.
A fairly large one, too.
Perhaps as big as a horse."
"Or a tiger."
The last remark produced an uneasy silence. Then Jimmy said,
"Well, if it comes to a fight, that flash of yours should scare anything."
"Only if it had eyes," said Gibson. "Suppose it had some other sense."
It was obvious that Jimmy was trying to think of good reasons for pressing ahead.
"I'm sure we could run faster and jump higher than anything else on Mars."
Gibson liked to believe that his decision was based on prudence rather than cowardice.
"We're not taking any risks," he said firmly. "We're going straight back to tell the others. Then we'll think about having a look round."
Jimmy had sense enough not to grumble, but he kept looking back wistfully as they returned to the ship. Whatever faults he might have, lack of courage was not among them. It took some time to convince the others that they were not attempting a rather poor practical joke. After all, everyone knew why there couldn't be animal life on Mars. It was a question of metabolism. Animals burned fuel so much faster than plants, and therefore could not exist in this thin, practically inert atmosphere. The biologists had been quick to point this out as soon as conditions on the surface of Mars had been accurately determined, and for the last 10 years the question of animal life on the planet had been regarded as settled, except by incurable romantics.
"Even if you saw what you think," said Hilton, "there must be some natural explanation."
"Come and see for yourself," retorted Gibson. "I tell you, it was a well-worn track."
"Oh, I'm coming," said Hilton.
"So am I," said the pilot.
"Wait a minute. We can't all go. At least one of us has got to stay behind."
For a moment, Gibson felt like volunteering. Then he realized that he would never forgive himself if he did.
"I found the track," he said firmly. "Looks as if I've got a mutiny on my hands," remarked Hilton. "Anyone got some money?"
Odd man out of you three stays behind.
It's a wild goose chase, anyway, said the pilot, when he produced the only head. I'd expect you home in an hour. If you take any longer, I'll want you to bring back a genuine Martian princess, a la Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Hilton, despite his skepticism, was taking the matter more seriously. There'll be three of us, he said, so it should be all right even if we do meet anything unfriendly. But just in case none of us come back, you're to sit right here and not go looking for us, understand?
Very well, I'll sit tight.
The trio set off across the valley towards the little forest, Gibson leading the way. After reaching the tall, thin fronds of seaweed, they had no difficulty in finding the track again. Hilton stared at it in silence for a good minute, while Gibson and Jimmy regarded him with I-told-you-so expressions. Then he remarked,
"Let's have your flash gun, Martin. I'm going first."
It would have been silly to argue. Hilton was taller, stronger, and more alert. Gibson handed over his weapon without a word. There can be no weirder sensation than that of walking along a narrow track between high leafy walls, knowing that at any moment you may come face to face with a totally unknown and perhaps unfriendly creature. Gibson tried to remind himself that animals which had never before encountered man were seldom hostile, though there were enough exceptions to this rule to make life interesting. They had gone about halfway through the forest when the track branched into two. Hilton took the turn to the right, but soon discovered that this was a cul-de-sac. It led to a clearing about 20 meters across, in which all the plants had been cut, or eaten, to within a short distance of the ground, leaving only the stumps showing. These were already beginning to sprout again, and it was obvious that this patch had been deserted for some time by whatever creatures had come here.
Herbivores, whispered Gibson.
And fairly intelligent, said Hilton. See the way they've left the roots to come up again? Let's go back along the other branch. They came across the second clearing 5 minutes later. It was a good deal larger than the first, and it was not empty. Hilton tightened his grip on the flash gun, and in a single, smooth, well-practiced movement, Gibson swung his camera into position and began to take the most famous photographs ever made on Mars. Then they all relaxed and stood waiting for the Martians to notice them. In that moment, centuries of fantasy and legend were swept away. All man's dreams of neighbors not unlike himself vanished into limbo. With them, unlamented, went Wells' tentacled monstrosities and the other legions of crawling nightmare horrors. And there vanished also the myth of coldly inhuman intelligences which might look down dispassionately on man from their fabulous heights of wisdom, and might brush him aside with no more malice than he himself might destroy a creeping insect. There were 10 of the creatures in the glade, and they were all too busy eating to take any notice of the intruders. In appearance, they resembled very plump kangaroos, their almost spherical bodies balanced on 2 large, slender hind limbs. They were hairless, and their skin had a curious waxy sheen like polished leather. 2 thin forearms, which seemed to be completely flexible, sprouted from the upper part of the body and ended in tiny hands, like the claws of a bird, too small and feeble, one would have thought, to have been of much practical use. Their heads were set directly on the trunk, with no suspicion of a neck, and bore 2 large pale eyes with wide pupils. There were no nostrils, only a very odd triangular mouth with 3 stubby bills which were making short work of the foliage. A pair of large, almost transparent ears hung limply from the head, twitching occasionally and sometimes folding themselves into trumpets, which looked as if they might be extremely efficient sound detectors, even in this thin atmosphere. The largest of the beasts was about as tall as Hilton, but all the others were considerably smaller. One baby less than a meter high could only be described by the overworked adjective, cute. It was hopping excitedly about, in an effort to reach the more succulent leaves, and from time to time emitted thin, piping cries which were irresistibly pathetic.
How intelligent would you say they are? Whispered Gibson at last.
It's hard to say,
Notice how they're careful not to destroy the plants they eat. Of course, that may be pure instinct, like bees knowing how to build their hives. They move very slowly, don't they? I wonder if they're warm-blooded. I don't see why they should have blood at all. Their metabolism must be pretty weird for them to survive in this climate. It's about time they took some notice of us. The big fellow knows we're here. I've caught him looking at us out of the corner of his eye. Do you notice the way his ears keep pointing towards us? Let's go out into the open. Hilton thought this over. I don't see how they can do us much harm, even if they want to. Those little hands look rather feeble. But I suppose those three-sided beaks could do some damage. We'll go forward very slowly for 6 paces. If they come at us, I'll give them a flash with the gun while you make a bolt for it. I'm sure we can outrun them easily. They certainly don't look built for speed. Moving with a slowness which they hoped would appear reassuring rather than stealthy, they walked forward into the glade. There was now no doubt that the Martians saw them. Half a dozen pairs of great, calm eyes stared at them, then looked away as their owners got on with the more important business of eating. "They don't even seem to be inquisitive," said Gibson, somewhat disappointed. "Are we as uninteresting as all this?" "Hello, Junior has spotted us. What's he up to?" The smallest Martian had stopped eating and was staring at the intruders with an expression that might have meant anything from rank disbelief to hopeful anticipation of another meal. It gave a couple of shrill squeaks, which were answered by a noncommittal honk from one of the adults. Then it began to hop towards the interested spectators. It halted a couple of paces away, showing not the slightest signs of fear or caution.
"How do you do?" said Hilton solemnly. "Let me introduce us. On my right, James Spencer. On my left, Martin Gibson. But I'm afraid I didn't quite catch your name."
"Squeak," said the small Martian.
"Well, Squeak, what can we do for you?"
The little creature put out an exploring hand and tugged at Hilton's clothing. Then it hopped towards Gibson, who had been busily photographing this exchange of courtesies. Once again it put forward an inquiring paw, and Gibson moved the camera around out of harm's way. He held out his hand, and the little fingers closed round it with surprising strength.
"Friendly little chap, isn't he?"
said Gibson, having disentangled himself with difficulty.
"At least he's not as stuck up as his relatives."
The adults had so far taken not the slightest notice of the proceedings. They were still munching placidly at the other side of the glade.
"I wish we had something to give him, but I don't suppose he could eat any of our food. Lend me your knife, Jimmy. I'll cut down a bit of seaweed for him, just to prove that we're friends."
This gift was gratefully received and promptly eaten, and the small hands reached out for more.
"You seem to have made a hit, Martin," said Hilton.
"I'm afraid it's cupboard, love," sighed Gibson.
"Hey, leave my camera alone. You can't eat that."
"I say," said Hilton suddenly, "there's something odd here. What color would you say this little chap is?"
"Why, brown in the front and, oh, a dirty gray at the back."
"Well, just walk to the other side of him and offer another bit of food."
Gibson obliged, Squeak rotating on his haunches so that he could grab the new morsel. And as he did so, an extraordinary thing happened. The brown covering on the front of his body slowly faded, and in less than a minute had become a dingy grey. At the same time, exactly the reverse happened on the creature's back, until the interchange was complete.
"Good Lord," said Gibson.
"It's just like a chameleon. What do you think the idea is? Protective coloration?"
"No, it's cleverer than that. Look at those others over there. You see, they're always brown, or nearly black, on the side towards the sun. It's simply a scheme to catch as much heat as possible and avoid re-radiating it. The plants do just the same. I wonder who thought of it first. It wouldn't be any use on an animal that had to move quickly, but some of those big chaps haven't changed position in the last 5 minutes."
Gibson promptly set to work photographing this peculiar phenomenon. Not a very difficult feat to do, as wherever he moved, Squeak always turned hopefully towards him and sat waiting patiently. When he had finished, Hilton remarked, "I hate to break up this touching scene, but we said we'd be back in an hour." "We needn't all go. Be a good chap, Jimmy. Run back and say that we're all right." But Jimmy was staring at the sky, the first to realize that for the last 5 minutes, an aircraft had been circling high over the valley. Their united cheer disturbed even the placidly browsing Martians, who looked round disapprovingly. It scared Squeak so much that he shot backwards in one tremendous hop, but soon got over his fright and came forward again. "See you later," called Gibson over his shoulder as they hurried out of the glade. The natives took not the slightest notice. They were halfway out of the little forest when Gibson suddenly became aware of the fact that he was being followed. He stopped and looked back. Making heavy weather but still hopping along gamely behind him was Squeak. "Shoo!" said Gibson, flapping his arms around like a distraught scarecrow. "Go back to Mother. I haven't got anything for you." It was not the slightest use, and his paws had merely enabled Squeak to catch up with him. The others were already out of sight, unaware that Gibson had dropped back. They therefore missed a very interesting cameo, as Gibson tried, without hurting Squeak's feelings, to disengage himself from his newfound friend. He gave up the direct approach after 5 minutes and tried guile. Fortunately, he had failed to return Jimmy's knife, and after much panting and hacking, managed to collect a small pile of seaweed, which he laid in front of Squeak. This, he hoped, would keep him busy for quite a while. He had just finished this when Hilton and Jimmy came hurrying back to find what had happened to him. "Okay, I'm coming along now," he said. "I had to get rid of Squeak somehow. That'll stop him following." The pilot in the crashed aircraft had been getting anxious, for the hour was nearly up, and there was still no sign of his companions. By climbing onto the top of the fuselage, he could see halfway across the valley, and to the dark area of vegetation into which they had disappeared. He was examining this when the rescue aircraft came driving out of the east and began to circle the valley. When he was sure it had spotted him, he turned his attention to the ground again. He was just in time to see a group of figures emerging into the open plain, and a moment later, he rubbed his eyes in rank disbelief. 3 people had gone into the forest, but 4 were coming out. And the 4th looked a very odd sort of person indeed. Chapter 13. After what was later to be christened the most successful crash in the history of Martian exploration, the visit to Trivium Charontis and Port Schiaparelli was inevitably something of an anticlimax. Indeed, Gibson had wished to postpone it altogether and to return to Port Lowell immediately with his prize. He had soon abandoned all attempts to jettison Squeak, and as everyone in the colony would be on tenterhooks to see a real live Martian, it had been decided to fly the little creature back with them. But Port Lowell would not let them return. Indeed, it was 10 days before they saw the capital again. Under the great domes, one of the decisive battles for the possession of the planet was now being fought. It was a battle which Gibson knew of only through the radio reports, a silent but deadly battle which he was thankful to have missed. The epidemic which Dr. Scott had asked for had arrived. At its peak, a tenth of the city's population was sick with Martian fever. But the serum from Earth broke the attack, and the battle was won with only 3 fatal casualties. It was the last time that the fever ever threatened the colony. Taking Squeak to Port Schiaparelli involved considerable difficulties, for it meant flying large quantities of his staple diet ahead of him. At first, it was doubted if he could live in the oxygenated atmosphere of the domes, but it was soon discovered that this did not worry him in the least, though it reduced his appetite considerably. The explanation of this fortunate accident was not discovered until a good deal later. What never was discovered at all was the reason for Squeak's attachment to Gibson. Someone suggested, rather unkindly, that it was because they were approximately the same shape. Before they continued their journey, Gibson and his colleagues, with the pilot of the rescue plane and the repair crew who arrived later, made several visits to the little family of Martians. They discovered only the one group, and Gibson wondered if these were the last specimens left on the planet. This, as it later turned out, was not the case. The rescue plane had been searching along the track of their flight when it had received a radio message from Phobos, reporting brilliant flashes in Etheria. Just how those flashes had been made had puzzled everyone considerably until Gibson, with justifiable pride, gave the explanation. When they discovered it would take only a few hours to replace the jet units on their plane, they had decided to wait while the repairs were carried out, and to use the time studying the Martians in their natural haunts. It was then that Gibson first suspected the secret of their existence. In the remote past, they had probably been oxygen breathers, and their life processes still depended on the element. They could not obtain it direct from the soil, where it lay in such countless trillions of tons, but the plants they ate could do so. Gibson quickly found that the numerous pods in the seaweed-like fronds contained oxygen under quite high pressure. By slowing down their metabolism, the Martians had managed to evolve a balance, almost a symbiosis, with the plants which provided them, literally, with food and air. It was a precarious balance, which, one would have thought, might have been upset at any time by some natural catastrophe. But conditions on Mars had long ago reached stability, and the balance would be maintained for ages yet, unless man disturbed it. The repairs took a little longer than expected, and they did not reach Port Schiaparelli until 3 days after leaving Port Lowell. The second city of Mars held less than 1,000 people, living under two domes on a long, narrow plateau. This had been the site of the original landing on Mars, and so the position of the city was really an historical accident. Not until some years later, when the planet's resources began to be better known, was it decided to move the colony's center of gravity to Lowell, and not to expand Schiaparelli any further. The little city was in many respects an exact replica of its larger and more modern rival. Its specialty was light engineering, geological, or rather, aerological research, and the exploration of the surrounding regions. The fact that Gibson and his colleagues had accidentally stumbled on the greatest discovery so far made on Mars, less than an hour's flight from the city, was thus the cause of some heartburning. The visit must have had a demoralizing effect on all normal activity in Port Schiaparelli, for wherever Gibson went, everything stopped while crowds gathered around Squeak. A favorite occupation was to lure him into a field of uniform illumination and to watch him turn black all over as he blissfully tried to extract the maximum advantage from this state of affairs. It was in Schiaparelli that someone hit on the deplorable scheme of projecting simple pictures onto Squeak and photographing the result before it faded. One day, Gibson was very annoyed to come across a photo of his pet bearing a crude but recognizable caricature of a well-known television star. On the whole, their stay in Port Schiaparelli was not a very happy one. After the first 3 days, they had seen everything worth seeing, and the few trips they were able to make into the surrounding countryside did not provide much of interest. Jimmy was continually worrying about Irene and putting through expensive calls to Port Lowell. Gibson was impatient to get back to the big city which, not so long ago, he had called an overgrown village. Only Hilton, who seemed to possess unlimited reserves of patience, took life easily and relaxed while the others fussed around him. There was one excitement during their stay in the city. Gibson had often wondered, a little apprehensively, what would happen if the pressurizing dome ever failed. He received the answer, or as much of it as he had any desire for, one quiet afternoon when he was interviewing the city's chief engineer in his office. Squeak had been with them, propped up on his large, flexible lower limbs like some improbable nursery doll. As the interview progressed, Gibson became aware that his victim was showing more than the usual signs of restiveness. His mind was obviously very far away, and he seemed to be waiting for something to happen. Suddenly, without warning, the whole building trembled slightly as if hit by an earthquake. Two more shocks, equally spaced, came in quick succession.
From a loudspeaker on the wall, a voice called urgently.
Blowout! Practice only! You have 10 seconds to reach shelter! Blowout! Practice only!
Gibson had jumped out of his chair, but immediately realized there was nothing he need do. From far away, there came a sound of slamming doors. Then silence. The engineer got to his feet and walked over to the window overlooking the city's only main street.
Everyone seems to have got to cover, he said. Of course, it isn't possible to make these tests a complete surprise. There's one a month, and we have to tell people what day it will be because they might think it was the real thing.
Just what are we all supposed to do? Asked Gibson, who had been told at least twice, but had become a little rusty on the subject.
As soon as you hear the signal, that's the 3 ground explosions, you've got to get under cover. If you're indoors, you have to grab your breathing mask to rescue anyone who can't make it. You see, if pressure goes, every house becomes a self-contained unit with enough air for several hours.
And anyone out in the open?
It would take a few seconds for the pressure to go right down, and as every building has its own airlock, it should always be possible to reach shelter in time. Even if you collapsed in the open, you'd probably be all right if you were rescued inside 2 minutes, unless you'd got a bad heart. And no one comes to Mars if he's got a bad heart.
Well, I hope you never have to put this theory into practice.
So do we. But on Mars, one has to be prepared for anything. Ah, there goes the all clear.
The speaker had burst into life again.
Exercise over. Will all those who failed to reach shelter in the regulation time please inform admin in the usual way? End of message.
Will they? Asked Gibson. I should have thought they'd keep quiet. The engineer laughed.
That depends. They probably will if it was their own fault. But it's the best way of showing up weak points in our defences. Someone will come and say, "Look here, I was cleaning one of the ore furnaces when the alarm went. It took me 2 minutes to get out of the blinking thing. What am I supposed to do if there's a real blowout?" Then we've got to think of an answer if we can.
Gibson looked enviously at Squeak, who seemed to be asleep, though an occasional twitch of the great translucent ears showed that he was taking some interest in the conversation.
It would be nice if we could be like him and didn't have to bother about air pressure. Then we could really do something with Mars.
I wonder, said the engineer thoughtfully, what have they done except survive? It's always fatal to adapt oneself to one's surroundings. The thing to do is to alter your surroundings to suit you.
The words were almost an echo of the remark that Hadfield had made at their first meeting. Gibson was to remember them often in the years to come. Their return to Port Lowell was almost a victory parade. The capital was in a mood of elation over the defeat of the epidemic, and it was now anxiously waiting to see Gibson and his prize. The scientists had prepared quite a reception for Squeak, the zoologists in particular being busily at work, explaining away their early explanations for the absence of animal life on Mars. Gibson had handed his pet over to the experts only when they had solemnly assured him that no thought of dissection had ever for a moment entered their minds. Then, full of ideas, he had hurried to see the chief. Hadfield had greeted him warmly. There was, Gibson was interested to note, a distinct change in the chief's attitude towards him. At first it had been, well, not unfriendly, but at least somewhat reserved. He had not attempted to conceal the fact that he considered Gibson's presence on Mars something of a nuisance, another burden to add to those he already carried. This attitude had slowly changed, until it was now obvious that the chief executive no longer regarded him as an unmitigated calamity.
"You've added some interesting citizens to my little empire," Hadfield said with a smile.
"I've just had a look at your engaging pet. He's already bitten the chief medical officer."
"I hope they're treating him properly," said Gibson anxiously.
"Who? The CMO?"
"No, Squeak, of course. What I'm wondering is whether there are any other forms of animal life we haven't discovered yet. Perhaps more intelligent."
"In other words, are these the only genuine Martians?"
"Yes."
"It'll be years before we know for certain, but I rather expect they are.
the conditions which make it possible for them to survive don't occur in many places on the planet. That was one thing I wanted to talk to you about. Gibson reached into his pocket and brought out a frond of the brown seaweed. He punctured one of the fronds, and there was the faint hiss of escaping gas. If this stuff is cultivated properly, it may solve the oxygen problem in the cities and do away with all our present complicated machinery. With enough sand for it to feed on, it would give you all the oxygen you need.
Go on, said Hadfield noncommittally. Of course, you'd have to do some selective breeding to get the variety that gave most oxygen,
continued Gibson, warming to his subject.
Naturally, replied Hadfield.
Gibson looked at his listener with a sudden suspicion, aware that there was something odd about his attitude. A faint smile was playing about Hadfield's lips.
I don't think you're taking me seriously, Gibson protested bitterly.
Hadfield sat up with a start.
On the contrary, he retorted. I'm taking you much more seriously than you imagine.
He toyed with his paperweight, then apparently came to a decision. Abruptly, he leaned towards his desk microphone and pressed a switch.
Get me a sand flea and a driver, he said. I want them at Lock 1 West in 30 minutes.
He turned to Gibson.
Can you be ready by then?
What?
Yes, I suppose so. I've only got to get my breathing gear from the hotel.
Good.
See you in half an hour.
Gibson was there 10 minutes early, his brain in a whirl. Transport had managed to produce a vehicle in time, and the chief was punctual as ever. He gave the driver instructions which Gibson was unable to catch, and the flea jerked out of the dome onto the road circling the city.
I'm doing something rather rash, Gibson, said Hadfield as the brilliant green landscape flowed past them. Will you give me your word that you'll say nothing of this until I authorize you?
Why, certainly, said Gibson, startled.
I'm trusting you, because I believe you're on our side, and haven't been as big a nuisance as I expected.
Thank you, said Gibson dryly.
And, because of what you've just taught us about our own planet, I think we owe you something in return.
The flea had swung round to the south, following the track that led up into the hills, and quite suddenly, Gibson realized where they were going.
Were you very upset when you heard that we'd crashed? Asked Jimmy anxiously.
Of course I was, said Irene. Terribly upset. I couldn't sleep for worrying about you.
Now it's all over, though. Don't you think it was worth it?
I suppose so. But somehow it keeps reminding me that in a month you'll be gone again. Oh, Jimmy, what shall we do then?
Deep despair settled upon the two lovers. All Jimmy's present satisfaction vanished into gloom. There was no escaping from this inevitable fact. The Ares would be leaving Deimos in less than 4 weeks, and it might be years before he could return to Mars. It was a prospect too terrible for words.
I can't possibly stay on Mars, even if they'd let me, said Jimmy. I can't earn a living until I'm qualified, and I've still got 2 years postgraduate work and a trip to Venus to do. There's only one thing for it.
Irene's eyes brightened, then she relapsed into gloom.
Oh, we've been through that before. I'm sure Daddy wouldn't agree.
Well, it won't do any harm to try. I'll get Martin to tackle him.
Mr. Gibson, do you think he would?
I know he will if I ask him, and he'll make it sound convincing.
I don't see why he should bother.
Oh, he likes me, said Jimmy with easy self-assurance. I'm sure he'll agree with us. It's not right that you should stick here on Mars and never see anything of Earth. Paris, New York, London, why, you haven't lived until you've visited them. Do you know what I think?
What?
Your father's being selfish in keeping you here.
Irene pouted a little. She was very fond of her father, and her first impulse was to defend him vigorously. But she was now torn between two loyalties, though in the long run,
there was no doubt which would win. "Of course," said Jimmy, realizing that he might have gone too far. "I'm sure he really means to do the best for you. But he's got so many things to worry about. He's probably forgotten what Earth is like and doesn't realize what you're losing. No, you must get away before it's too late." Irene still looked uncertain. Then her sense of humor, so much more acute than Jimmy's, came to the rescue.
"I'm quite sure that if we were on Earth and you had to go back to Mars, you'd be able to prove just as easily that I ought to follow you there."
Jimmy looked a little hurt, then realized that Irene wasn't really laughing at him.
"All right," he said. "That's settled. I'll talk to Martin as soon as I see him, and ask him to tackle your dad. So let's forget all about it until then, shall we?"
They did, very nearly. The little amphitheatre in the hills above Port Lowell was just as Gibson had remembered it, except that the green of its lush vegetation had darkened a little, as if it had already received the first warning of the still far-distant autumn. The sand flea drove up to the largest of the four small domes, and they walked over to the airlock.
"When I was here before," said Gibson dryly, "I was told we'd have to be disinfected before we could enter."
"A slight exaggeration to discourage unwanted visitors," said Hatfield unabashed. The outer door had opened at his signal, and they quickly stripped off their breathing apparatus.
"We used to take such precautions, but they're no longer necessary."
The inner door slid aside and they stepped through into the dome. A man wearing the white smock of the scientific worker, the clean white smock of the very senior scientific worker, was waiting for them.
"Hello, Baines," said Hatfield. "Gibson, this is Professor Baines. I expect you've heard of each other."
They shook hands. Baines, Gibson knew, was one of the world's greatest experts on plant genetics. He had read a year or two ago that he had gone to Mars to study its flora.
"So you're the chap who's just discovered Oxyphera," said Baines dreamily.
He was a large, rugged man with an absent-minded air which contrasted strangely with his massive frame and determined features.
"Is that what you call it?" asked Gibson. "Well, I thought I'd discovered it, but I'm beginning to have doubts." "You certainly discovered something quite as important," Hatfield reassured him. "But Baines isn't interested in animals, so it's no good talking to him about your Martian friends."
They were walking between low temporary walls which Gibson saw partitioned the dome into numerous rooms and corridors. The whole place looked as if it had been built in a great hurry. They came across beautiful scientific apparatus, supported on rough packing cases, and everywhere there was an atmosphere of hectic improvisation. Yet, curiously enough, very few people were at work. Gibson obtained the impression that whatever task had been going on here was now completed, and that only a skeleton staff was left. Baines led them to an airlock connecting with one of the other domes, and as they waited for the last door to open, he remarked quietly, "This may hurt your eyes a bit." With this warning, Gibson put up his hand as a shield. His first impression was one of light and heat. It was almost as if he had moved from pole to tropics in a single step. Overhead, batteries of powerful lamps were blasting the hemispherical chamber with light. There was something heavy and oppressive about the air that was not only due to the heat, and he wondered what sort of atmosphere he was breathing. This dome was not divided up by partitions. It was simply a large circular space laid out into neat plots, on which grew all the Martian plants which Gibson had ever seen, and many more besides. About a quarter of the area was covered by tall brown fronds, which Gibson recognized at once.
"So you've known about them all the time," he said,
neither surprised nor particularly disappointed. Hatfield was quite right. The Martians were much more important.
"Yes," said Hatfield. "They were discovered about 2 years ago and aren't very rare along the equatorial belt. They only grow where there's plenty of sunlight, and your little crop was the farthest north they've ever been found. It takes a great deal of energy to split the oxygen out of the sand," explained Baines.
We've been helping them here with these lights and trying some experiments of our own. Come and look at the result.